Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 27 of season 4 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan rom-com When Harry Met Sally, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Alan Sanders of The Wild Ride, and of the Alan Sanders Show, and of all these other crazy things.
I am a broadcaster. Yes, thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming back. You know, it's, I think we had a nice conversation yesterday, and you know, hopefully today that will continue. Even though we're not going to talk about Barbie and Ken today. So
okay, I am looking forward to what possible trivia questions you're going to have lined up for me.
Ooh.
Because I went through the dialogue, and I was so focused on the sincerity of Billy Crystal trying to explain exactly how all of this went down. And I'm like, what in the world could be picked apart? And I have no idea.
I have two main things that we're going to talk about today. We'll go through the dialogue, and then we'll go back to those two things. I think that okay. works a little better. Because one of the things with a movie like this where the dialogue is – where it's very dialogue heavy is that, you know, to cut it up without saying it all first – is, you know, counterproductive. So we'll just go through the whole dialogue that's here. So minute 27 begins with the wave continuing and ends with Harry responding to Jess. So yesterday we ended things with, you know, just seeing a football stadium, seeing our beloved loser Lions losing once again, or playing a game that they will lose, you know, to the Giants. And, you know, that's how the minute ended. And today we continue with another shot of the crowd. And then the crowd, you know, sits down. And then we have a shot of two men sitting and talking. One of them is, you know, someone that we have already met, Harry Burns. And we don't know who the other guy is. You know, I mean, we do, but, you know, we're not really sure just by looking at it. You know, so we have Harry sitting there talking to his friend Jess, and they have a very interesting conversation. So we'll go through the conversation and then we'll pick it apart. So
okay,
Jess turns to Harry and says, "When did this happen?" "Friday." Helen comes home from work and she says, "I don't know if I want to be married anymore. Like it's the institution, you know, like it's nothing personal, just something she's been thinking about in a casual way." I'm calm. I say, "Why don't we take some time to think about it? You know, don't rush into anything." "Yeah, right." Next day, she says she's thought about it and she wants a trial separation. "She just wants to try it," she says. "But we can still date. Like this is supposed to cushion the blow. I mean, I got married so I can stop dating. So I don't see where we can still date is any big incentive. Since the last thing you want to do is date your wife, who's supposed to love you. Which is what I'm saying when it occurs to me that maybe she doesn't. So I say to her, 'Don't you love me anymore?' You know what she says? 'I don't know if I've ever loved you.'" Jess responds, "Oh, that's harsh." And then once again, we hear the crowd. They go through another wave. And then Jess says, "You don't bounce back from that right away." "Thanks, Jess." And that's pretty much the whole dialogue of this minute.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, first of all, I like the fact that, you know, beforehand, they showed us, it was 2 weeks ago, Marie and Alice. And then it jumps, and then now we see, you know, Harry talking to his friend, Jess. So I like the contrast here. You know, it's showing that the two of them have their own lives. They have their own friends. They have their circle of people that they talk to, their confidants, you know, which, I mean, we'll get both of them later on throughout the movie, you know, constantly, you know, still talking to these other people along the way while they're still talking to each other, you know, the whole thing. So
I like this because to me, this is that kind of, once again, we talked about it a little bit yesterday, the rom-com formula. You've got her and her friends, and it's happening in parallel with him and his friends. And we kind of, as the audience, know because of the poster, because of the title, because of what's happening, we know they're on a collision course at some point. But I like it because we see them as like parallel stories that eventually are going to collide.
Correct. And it works well. I mean, as you said, the rom-com trope usually is that each of them have one best friend that they're always talking to about everything that's going on. You know, and this movie fits right in with that. You know, there's no question about that.
I have a question about the story he's telling, and cool. And if you want me to re-ask it later, but, and you just want to edit this out, but I was thrown, and every time I hear it, I still don't hear it the way he thinks it means. We can still date. The minute I heard that, I thought that meant, well, we'll try out other people,
right,
while we're on our trial separation. He makes it sound like, well, let's separate, but maybe we can have date nights to see if we can maybe get back together.
Right.
Which I don't know anybody that when they're trying a trial separation and says, but we can date. I've never heard anybody mean it with each other.
Right. It's the idea of trying out other people and saying, okay, maybe I can find someone a little better than you. You know, that type of thing, which makes sense. So the first thing that I want to talk about, which we're going to talk about in length here, is the wave. Okay. I know you're a sports fan.
Uh-huh, I am.
Okay. So first of all, do you know any other names for the wave?
No, actually I don't. That's how it's always been. Even when you go and they say start the wave, it actually says it on the billboards, you know?
So. Correct. Well, because it's, you know, shorter, I guess you can say. There's two other terms that are used for the wave. It's either known as, first of all, just to explain to people, if you don't know what a wave is something that usually happens in a stadium where each section will stand up. And then when they sit down, the next section stands up. And when you're looking at it from afar, it looks as if, you know, there's like a wave happening, you know, around the stadium, because most of the stadiums are circular, you know, so it just looks like a wave happening. Okay. So
it's a lot of times when I've gone to stadiums that are double decker stadiums, they have lower and upper. Sometimes the wave will go in both the upper and lower in the same direction, or sometimes just to make it look interesting, it'll go in opposite directions. You'll have one that's going really cool. Clockwise and then one going counterclockwise.
That's really cool. That's really cool. So the wave is known also as the Mexican wave or the stadium wave. Those are
still the wave.
Official term. Of course, it's still the wave, but
you know. I was waiting for you to tell me also known as the stampede or the jigger jog.
No. Sorry.
Okay.
No jigger jog. Sorry to disappoint you there. But so basically, when do you think the wave was first introduced or invented? You can even say.
I remember seeing it. Let's see. Before I moved, I went to Tiger Stadium, I think in 82 or 83, and it was going on then. So either late 70s, early 80s, maybe.
Perfect. Bullseye. So it was actually originated on the 15th of November, 1979, at an NHL game between the Colorado Rockies and Montreal Canadiens in Denver. Okay, there's a man named Crazy George Henderson. I don't know why he's known as Crazy George Henderson. When I think of that name, it makes me think of Kramer. You know, when I'm trying to visualize who this Crazy George is. You know, there also was Crazy Eddie. You know, are you familiar with the Crazy Eddie commercials? It was mostly in the New York area, but
I can't say that I do.
So Crazy Eddie is a guy who started an electronic store in the New York area in 1971, and he was known as Crazy Eddie because, you know, his prices were insane and they had all these different commercials, and it was just amazing to listen to. I mean, he had in the end, I think, 43 stores in 4 states. And but what was the problem? He actually got caught in fraud and overreporting profits, inflating inventory, duping auditors, stuff like that. And
he was crazy.
He fled the country. And guess what country he came to? My country. He came to Israel.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Now, you know, when you describe those kinds of commercials, I don't remember who they were, but I remember in Detroit, and obviously when something is big in one area, people hear about it, and so they just emulate it. Like, that's why a lot of the car commercials, especially used cars, look so similar. They do the same kind of shtick.
Right.
But I remember we had somebody who would do things like the camera would pan along, and he'd have, like, all these appliances set up, and he was crazy somebody. I have no idea who, but I remember he had a bat, and he would go, $49 for a microwave? No way. And he crushed the microwave. He goes, I won't sell this for less than $29. And then he would beat up. So basically, he just went down the line just bashing all of these products, wow. Talking about how he was going to cut those prices. He wasn't going to pay those kinds of prices if you come down to whatever his Highland appliance or whatever the name of his store was.
Right. So, I mean, he fled to Israel in February of 1990, and they actually deported him back to America 3 years later, in January 93. He stood trial, and the conviction was overturned. But then a few years later, he actually pled guilty and got 8 years in prison for it.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. He got 8 years in prison, but it was only in prison for 2 years. So whatever. That is crazy Eddie. What do you expect? But I mean, that's not the crazy Eddie that I was looking for. I was looking for a crazy George. But still, mm-hmm. You know, just you know, maybe I'll put up a few of Crazy Eddie's commercials for everyone to see here. You know,
I wonder if Crazy George is the one who came up with the wave.
Yes.
I wonder if it's just that sports fan that just gets a name. You know, for the Atlanta Braves, for folks who've been around in a long time, back when it was Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, the Braves were so bad, you'd be lucky if you could get maybe a couple of thousand people to show up to a game. So someone came up with this idea. Well, they're the Atlanta Braves, which has a connotation to the American Indian. So he put up a giant teepee because they were like, okay, you know what? Nobody's sitting out there anyway in the outfield or in the stands in the outfield. So he would behind, I don't know if it was left field or center field, he put out a giant teepee. He went by the name Chief Nakahoma.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And he would do home run dances all the time. And he became such a draw, people came to the Braves, not because the Braves were doing any well, but because they wanted to see Chief Nakahoma do his little shtick. He became almost like a character for the Atlanta Braves.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. So he, I just read what he was a cheerleader. He started off as a cheerleader in California State University in San Jose and ended up, you know, working his way into the NHL as a cheerleader.
Oh, that's Crazy George. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy George. You know, he did some crazy things, obviously, but he was the one who actually invented it. Okay. He used to do it at the NHL games. And then on October 15th, 1981, He was in a baseball game in Oakland, and this is the first time that they have a video documentation of a wave. And he actually uses this as proof that he is the inventor of the wave.
That's right? Kind of cool, though.
Yes.
I mean, to have started something, and especially in a hockey game, which, I mean, hockey's gotten a lot more popular in the United States. And it had its pockets, but it was nowhere near the kind of viewing audience of, let's say, baseball or football. Even basketball gets a bigger audience. Hockey's kind of like a second-tier sport.
Right.
In terms of, you know, money and profit.
Well, at least back in the 70s and 80s. Nowadays, it might be a little different, but back then, that's the way it was.
Think about that, to have pioneered something that is still happening to this day. I went to a baseball game last year, and the wave broke out.
Yes. But wait, I'm not done with all of the information about the wave. So then
you sound like that, but wait, there's more.
But wait, there is more.
Act now.
That's right. Act now and Crazy Eddie will throw in a broken microwave. Yeah. So then it moved in to the University of Washington. There was a football game against Stanford that they started using a wave. And basically Henderson's, the people in Seattle said that they got the idea from him, but they claimed that they actually were the ones who popularized it. You know, he invented it, but they popularized it. So Henderson basically says that it was inspired by accident when he was leading cheers at the Colorado Rockies game. And his routine was to have one side of the arena jump and cheer, then have the opposite side respond. And then one night in late 1979, there was a delayed response from one of the sections of fans, leading them to jump to their feet a few seconds later than the section beside them. The next section of fans followed suit, and the first wave circled McNichols Arena on its own accord. So it's pretty cool that something happened. You know,
it's almost like it was a spontaneous accident.
Yes.
That's kind of cool, though, that there was just a delayed reaction. And because of the delay kind of rippled and everybody started following. And then you have to wonder, because I was really young. I mean, early 80s for me, when I remember seeing it at Tiger Stadium, I may have been 12, 11 or 12 years old. So is it?
Wait, when did
it
you move? TV? When did you move from Detroit?
In 85. So I didn't move to Georgia until the summer of 85.
Okay, well, it wasn't in 82 that you saw it, that I can tell you, because I'm about to explain how it got to Michigan. Because Michigan is a very important part in the history of the Wave. So in the fall of 1983, the Wolverines, the Michigan Wolverines, you know, from
from college football, the Big
college
Ten.
Football, U of M in Ann Arbor. Right. So they basically the Wave caught on in their games. And apparently they claim that there are three reasons that it happened. One, it gave the fans something to do while the team was leading its opponent by 40 points. You know, second, it was thrilling and exciting to see 105,000 people in the stands moving and cheering. And the third reason is because Bo Schembechler,
he was
the coach, asked them not to do it. but
that's funny.
They created a whole bunch of different types of waves along the way. They did silent waves, which basically means that, you know, you're not cheering. Everyone's just standing up. Okay. You have shush waves, where everyone would do shushing sounds. And then you had a fast wave, slow wave. One of the things you mentioned earlier, the two simultaneous waves traveling in opposite directions. And then in the spring of 1984, many fans who enjoyed the Wave in Ann Arbor introduced it at Tiger Stadium. And that year, the Tigers were in the World Series, and it appeared on many of the televised games throughout 1984. And therefore, people in the U.S. got to see what a Wave was. So you see, There's that Detroit connection.
The tie-in. So it was at Tiger Stadium.
Yeah. Tiger Stadium was the one that was the place that really popularized it around the whole U.S. in 1984. Okay.
Well, I remember I was at Tiger. So I guess I got the year wrong, but I guess it was 84 then versus 83. I knew it was before I moved because it was the Tigers game.
Right. Exactly.
So that would have made me in 84. I would have been 13.
Okay. Right.
Unless it was late. No, I didn't go to the World Series, so it wasn't late in the year. So I didn't turn 14 until late November of that year. So I would have been 13 and a half.
Right. Okay. And
I would have been a fledgling teenager.
I was 10, and I didn't go to any of the World Series games that year either. I went to there were some games I went in the summer, but you know, once the Tigers started doing really well, there were no seats available.
You know, I used to like the Tigers only because my dad, it was a sport I learned you could see the game in your head through radio. We would play it in the garage. It's a great sport to listen to if you have a good radio broadcaster. But I loved at the time and became a Tigers fan, not just because we lived there, but you know how kids think. You had the shortstop, Alan Trammell,
yeah,
and he spelled his name the right way, A-L-A-N, which is how I spell it. I don't spell it like a last name, A-L-L-E-N. Mm-hmm. That's a last name, not a first name. So I was like, oh, Alan Trammell. Well, that's who I want to be. And I didn't know anything about baseball or players, but I was just like, I liked him because he had my name.
Right. Now, I remember there was Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, and what was the catcher's name? Lance something.
Man, you're stretching my memory.
Mine too. Mine too.
Oh my God, I can't think of it. Now I'm going to have to look it up because now it's killing me. Lance Parrish.
Lance Parrish. There you go. You're right.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember all three of those guys. I was sad when Alan Trammell didn't get into the Hall of Fame, you know, the year that he was eligible. But, you know, and Jack Morris.
You're bringing back so many good memories just talking about baseball, and then all of a sudden we switched it to the Tigers, and just remembering, you know, the games. Growing up, the big thing was my dad, I mean, and your dad may have at the same time, being in the late 70s and early 80s, you could still do most of the stuff on your car yourself. Mm-hmm. So he would be in the garage doing things like changing spark plugs or changing the oil, and he would have the radio on, and I would come out there and learn how to help him by handing him tools and stuff.
Listening and to Al Kaline.
Listening to the baseball.
You know, wasn't Al Kaline the...
And Ernie Harwell?
And Ernie Harwell. There you go. All right. So back to the Wave. So the Wave actually became popular internationally during the 1986 World Cup in Mexico. So, you know, that's where that came from. Okay, so I've two last things about the Wave, and they're questions for you. Okay, how many people do you think were involved in the world's record of the largest number of people doing a wave?
Well, knowing how big concerts can be, but I don't know if you do them.
Do you want me to tell you about what event this was? Would that help?
That would help.
Okay, so there, John Stewart and Stephen Colbert in 2010 created a rally to restore sanity and fear. Okay, which they did in Washington. I actually remember when they did that.
So
they did the wave there.
My gut was to say 1 million, but I'm going to say 500,000.
210,000 people.
210. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. And
still, that's not too bad.
No, not at all. That's great. And how long do you think is the record for the longest continuous wave?
No, they tend to fade after a bit. So I'm gonna say 10 minutes.
So up until 2019, the record was 17 minutes and 14 seconds, which was at a concert in Japan. By the group Tube. I've never heard of them, but maybe you have. I don't know. Okay.
Nope.
And that record was broken on the 23rd of June, 2019, at the season 7 finals of the Rocket League Championship Series, which is a video game esport in Newark, New Jersey.
I know Rocket League.
You familiar with it or not?
I'm familiar with the game, Rocket League, yeah.
All right. And they did a continuous wave for 28 minutes and 35 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time to do the wave.
Yes.
I'm done after it goes around its third time around the stadium. I'm like, okay, come on, I'm done. I want to drink my beer.
That's right. Well, you can still keep drinking your beer. Why not?
Well, yeah, but you don't want to jump up and have your hands, because you're supposed to put your hands up. You're supposed to do it right. You're supposed to raise both hands to help make all this movement, so that way it's not just standing up, but you're doing all this kinetic energy.
Well, Harry and Jess don't do that. They just stand up.
I know they talking. Don't.
You know, I mean, one of
you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Go back and do it again. You're doing it wrong.
Cut.
That's
back
right.
to one.
one of the things that I love about this conversation between the two of them is that it seems to pick up in the middle of a conversation. You know, these guys are having this conversation already, you know, because he starts off by saying, when did this happen? So, you know, he said something else beforehand.
Right.
You know,
what I love about it is you don't need to know what it was. You immediately, within the first couple of back and forth, you know exactly what they're talking
about. Correct. You know, and the two of them, like when they have the second wave that they're a part of, so Jeff shakes his head as the wave is about to come, and then the two of them, he's shaking his head and then raises his arms and stands up, you know, as he's doing it. So it works really well. Now, did you probably didn't notice this, but actually, before we get there, we have one other thing I want to talk about. So they talk about, you know, separation, marital separation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Trial separation. Let's give it a try. See what you think.
Exactly.
See if it works.
Correct. So what do you know about the legal aspects of a separation, a trial separation or whatever? You know anything about that?
Well, I know what it is to get separated and divorced, having been through one.
So do I.
But I don't know what I don't know if what the legal, like what's the difference between a separation and the true divorce. In fact, I don't even know if there is a difference
there
anymore.
There is a difference.
I know the divorce itself is you've got a court-ordered contract that says you are no longer identified as married in the eyes of the state.
Right. Okay. So basically a marital separation or a legal separation is that, two married people who stop living together, but they don't get a divorce. Okay. Sometimes this could be the initial steps in the divorce process. Sometimes it could be for people who want to gain perspective on their marriage and decide whether they want a divorce or not. Right. Some people do it instead of getting divorced for economic reasons, for religious reasons, for tax purposes. Sometimes people have like insurance benefits, stuff like that, that they don't want to lose because of that, even though they no longer want to be together. Sometimes it can be done.
I have heard that. I've heard people that they care so much about making sure the other one's okay in terms of health or whatever, that they'll stay, quote, married. So the one person, the one spouse that's got the benefits package, that the other person still qualifies to go to the doctor and get, you know, has insurance and everything. But they're technically, like you said, they're not living in the same domicile. They don't even think of themselves as together anymore.
Right. Exactly. But in with a separation, you don't have any legal documents like with a divorce that deals with alimony and custody and things like that. Those are things that people have to decide on their own for the way that they're doing that. Okay. There are actually states that separation is grounds for divorce. You can use that as your reason to get divorced. There are also states where you have to be separated for a certain amount of time before you can even file for divorce. You know, you can't just run to the court and, file for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
According to experts, whatever experts really means, they say that if you have a 6-month separation, that's the perfect amount of time that is still considered a temporary separation because it's long enough to set up a second household and gain perspective, but also not long enough to feel too permanent, to be separated. There are other names for legal separation. You have judicial separation, separate maintenance, divorce a mensa et thoro, okay, or divorce from bed and board. You ever heard that phrase before?
Okay. No. You just have to be kicked out of the house? Is that basically what it's saying?
No. What it's basically saying is that the separation is sanctioned by the court, but the spouses legally live apart, but they're still legally married, right? So if they have any future children that are born, so, the legitimacy of any child remains the same, but you also they can't legally remarry anyone else during that time period. That they're together or that they're considered from bed to board, because the idea is that you're no longer living together, but you're still considered married as far as the law is concerned from that perspective.
Yeah, but the term from bed to board, I usually think that means like your household or domicile. So does it mean that you're not, again, like I said, is it you're not living in the same house or you're not living in the same bedroom? In other words, you have separate rooms.
No, according to what it says here, it's that the separation is you're in different houses, because they're saying
it is different houses. Okay.
The actual translation of the Latin means from table and bed, which they changed to board mm-hmm. and table. You know, the idea of food and stuff like that, that you're no longer mm-hmm. room and board type of thing.
No more food, no more fun. Aww.
Well, if you've reached the point, if you've reached the point where you want to separate, I don't think you're looking for fun with the same spouse.
That's true. That's true.
Could be one of the reasons. So right as this minute is about to end, you have about 2 or 3 seconds left. They do, the second wave, and mm-hmm. there's a man right in front of Harry and Jess that is talking on a cell phone. In 1989, cell phones were not as prevalent as they are today. So it's fun to actually see that you know, in retrospect. I mean, I know I've seen in movies from the 80s people who have car phones. Mm-hmm. I even remember that there was a guy that I know that his car was stolen, and he called up his cell phone, the car phone, to convince the guy. He said, "Keep the car, but I need my documents inside the car." Maybe he was a lawyer. I don't remember what his profession was, but he needed some important documents in the car. And he's like, "Keep the car, but get me back the documents that are in there." I don't know what happened, if he ever got it or not, but I just thought it was, that's something that I always remember from my childhood, that I remember, a friend of mine's father, that's what he did. I even remember what kind of, he had like a Jeep. But can you imagine, you steal a car and then the phone rings and you answer it? It's like, hello.
Hey, dude, I need my stuff.
That's right.
What's crazy about this is being involved in technology. I worked for a small little like a gadget computer shop. It was called Radio Shack when I was a kid, just as a job when I was going to late high school and then college. We sold cell phones all the time. I remember my dad thinking it was the coolest thing to have first the bag phone, where the receiver and handset looked like what you would have permanently mounted in your car,
right,
but it had a big bag battery that you would strap over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned into the brick phone, where it looked like a big giant brick with a huge antenna on it. And we've had cell phones. So well before this movie would have been made, my mom and dad had portable cell phones and car phones probably starting about 86 or 87.
Okay. Do you know what year the cell phone was created? Invented?
Oh, well before then. The one that you mount in your car, or the one that you walk around with?
The first handheld mobile phone.
Yeah, it was called the StarTAC, I think, something. And I remember it. Oh, I just did a stupid program about it last year for the Telescience Museum. We did this thing about, because they did about gadgets, about science fiction in inspiring real world things, and then real world things that might be inspiration for what do we think they'll look like 100 years from now in like science fiction. So
I love that concept. I remember years and years ago, I was with a friend and we were in some rest stop or something like that, and that was when they just had started having the urinals would automatically flush, and this was in the late 80s when this happened. And my friend turns to me and goes, "Wow, I feel like I'm in Star Trek." And the mm-hmm. idea of the fact that sci-fi has created technology and vice mm-hmm. versa is just amazing to me.
I think I call it the StarTAC, but I think that was the first flip phone, or that was the because it was based on Star Trek, but like the DynaTAC, Motorola. It was Motorola.
That it was.
I remember the story because we had it on the poster when we were talking about it. The person made a phone call on the streets of New York.
Martin Cooper was the first person, was the creator of the cell phone.
Yeah, but I thought you wanted the first mobile phone.
Yes.
Maybe Martin Cooper.
No, he demonstrated the first handheld mobile phone.
Yeah,
it was in New York, you were right.
Yes, it was in New York because he called somebody from a building, a competitor. 74, 73, 72?
Oh, you were about to say 73. Great.
73, okay.
Yeah, you got that one perfect. Right. Now, between 1983 and 2014, the worldwide mobile phone subscriptions grew to over 7 billion, meaning that there was enough, even in 2014, there were already enough phones to provide one for every single person in the world. I mean, that's just amazing, the number of people that it's considered as one of the most important human inventions because of the fact that it is the most widely used and sold piece of consumer technology.
Mm-hmm.
In 1999 in England, the total number of mobile phones was actually larger than the total number of houses. That they had. And in half the world's countries, more than 90% of the population own at least one cell phone.
Isn't that crazy? And that's just saying cell really phone. Is. That's not even taking into account the advent of the smartphone, which is...
Correct. We're not even talking about smartphones at this point. Now, this last bit of trivia I think is great. That Motorola did a study that found that for every 1 in 10 mobile phone subscribers, okay, there is someone who has a second phone that is kept secret from other family members. These phones are usually used in activities as extramarital affairs or clandestine business dealings and things like that.
Well, and now we're in that whole age of the burner phone. You just buy however many minutes you want. If you want to throw it away, you're done. Nope.
That's right. Especially if you're a spy in a movie.
Yep. Yeah. Or 24. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And 24 was 20 years ago. Think about it from that perspective, too.
Well, see, that hurts my soul. You know, aging, the problem with it is it just keeps happening.
Yes, that is
it
true.
It doesn't stop.
No, but you know what? I wish upon you that aging will continue for you for many, many years to come. How's
it
that?
Beats the alternative. Yes, you're right.
That's right, for sure.
Yeah, I guess any day I wake up on the right side of the dirt is a good day.
Very true. Very true. So that's all I have to talk about for this minute. Did you have anything else you want to mention?
No, I like his delivery here. I love Harry's. It's kind of wry. He's not, it's almost matter of fact. Like he's finally come to terms with it. He's not emotional about it. He's not overly happy, but the way he delivers it is a little bit humorous because it's almost too matter of fact. And I kind of like it. I like that's the way he's telling the story.
Right. And we're not used to Harry acting this way. Also, we expect him to be darker, you know, but again, he's in a bad place right now, mm-hmm. you know, because it's also just happened. You know, he did just say this just happened on Friday. And my assumption is that this is Sunday.
Oh yeah. Cause
you know, they're at a football game. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yesterday I talked about, we talked about it yesterday, what when this game was. So, you know, the game was on October 16th, 1988, which was a Sunday. Yes. So I guess
it would have been the 14th.
Harry and Helen, that's right. Harry and Helen had their discussion on October 14th. And then on the 15th, she told him that you know, she doesn't want to be married to him. That, you know, that she thought about it. Mm. So, yeah.
Bananas.
Pretty quick. Completely. All right. So the script in for this minute, there isn't very much that's different. I just like the descriptive aspect here. Okay. It says a wave is in progress. It sweeps around the stadium and passes by Harry and his friend Jess, sitting in the second deck, surrounded by Mets fans. Remember, we talked yesterday that this is supposed to be
a baseball
in
game.
Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
All right. It's fall. They're both wearing jeans and windbreakers. Harry is very despondent. And then they have the whole story. And then it says, a wave comes through the crowd and Harry and Jess stand and wave their hands. You know, throughout the, you know, during the course of their conversation. And then it immediately says they sit down. And then it continues the conversation. So that's pretty much all they have from the script here. So every Tuesday, we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Dating Courting Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that has happened to them over the course of their lives that is related to either dating or courting. So, Alan, you have a story for us by any chance?
Wait a minute. Do I? Me? Yeah, I've got one.
Hey, you want to bring someone else to tell a story? You can do that too.
No, I'll tell the story, and it really is the story of how my current wife, my now would be considered my second wife, how our relationship changed, because we knew of each other. We had been involved in theater. Our kids had done things together. We ran in a group of people, so we really all knew kind of that whole circle of the local theater people, artistic people. So, you know, 30, 40 people we would see all the time, do things with. It was just kind of like the group. And when my marriage fell apart, didn't realize hers was also falling apart. And so we ended up, some other people had gone through divorces. Other people had never been married. So we then did this thing. We were trying to be really funny. When we didn't have our kids, we would do things called the Lonely Hearts Club weekends, where someone would host a dinner and it would be like a potluck. We could all get together for a board night, game night, whatever. But we were just really good friends. Like we could relate to one another, but it was never a thought of doing anything beyond being friends. And just because we're on the backside of New Year's Eve, what started it all is one New Year's Eve. It was and for the folks who have gone through divorce schedules, you know that they try to alternate the holiday weekend. So if you have your kids from Christmas to New Year's, then they switch. And then the next time that you have them up to Christmas, but then you're by yourself from Christmas half of the day through New Year's. So it was a year where we didn't have our kids. They were with their respective other sides of the divorced family. And so we all decided, a bunch of us, we're going to go down to this club in Atlanta for New Year's Eve and celebrate the New Year's. And right as midnight was approaching, because, I mean, we're not dating. Nobody's dating. We're all just hanging out. I'm like, well, I don't have anybody I'm here to kiss at midnight. I'm going to go outside. And I said, hey, I'm going to go outside, call my kids. I'll be back in like 10 minutes. So I go outside, call them, wish them Happy New Year, whatever. I come back. I couldn't find her for like 10, 15 minutes. And then all of a sudden, I'm searching around. I finally found her, and I realized something wasn't right. Something was really weird. She acted like in the 10 minutes I was gone that she had had like 12 drinks simultaneously. Like she had just taken like a row of shots or something. She was getting slurred speech, blurry eyes, started acting like she was like really upset. She goes, where'd you go? I've lost you. I don't know where you are. I'm like, what are you talking about? I told you I was going to call my kids. She said, I don't feel right. Something's wrong. I want to go. I was like, okay. So we got in the car and she started acting like totally ready to just pass out. We both have talked about it since. We think somebody, because I have, quote, left her to go outside, someone probably slipped something into her drink. And she tells the girls all the time that here she is. She goes, you know, I'm so used to going to college bars. I had a life, you know, when I was in college, I hung out with a bunch of people. I went to New York. I lived in New York City in a small apartment. I would go out every evening for happy hour and girls free drinks hour. So she goes, I thought to myself, I'm a pretty careful person. I'm pretty experienced in the bar scene. And she says to the girls, our daughters all the time, she said, and even I must have for a split second took my eye off the drink and somebody put something in it, because it's the only explanation for how drugged I felt afterwards. Because when I got her home, and thankfully I was worried she was going to get sick in the car or something, got her back to my house, and there she was in no condition to drive to her house because she had come. We had driven down together. So I was like, you're going to just have to spend the night. And she's like, and she's totally out of it. And she ended up spending the night, but, you know, obviously nothing happened. I'm not that kind of a guy. And the next day she was
besides
like,
you slipping her a Mickey.
Yeah, no, it wasn't me. Right. Trust me, it wasn't me.
yeah, but, like you would tell us that it was you. Yeah. Was Bill Cosby there?
Yeah. I love putting things in your drink. No. So the long and the short of it is the next day, I think we both realized she felt I took care of her when she could have been taken advantage of and was at her most vulnerable. And I felt like I enjoyed the fact that she trusted me to take care of her and to keep her safe. And something clicked. And we talked later and I said, are we thinking about maybe going out now? And she goes, I don't want to screw this up. We're great friends. We have great times. Our kids like each other. What happens if this fails? I'm like, I don't know, but maybe we got to give it a shot. And here we are 13 plus years later, married.
There you go.
We've been married for 13 plus years. We dated for a couple, but you know, initially neither one of us wanted to get married. That's a story I can save for the other day. But we both decided, you know what? You talk about, you know, it's the opposite of divorce is the separation, you know, or being married is the separation phase that we talked about. We wanted to we'll just common law live together. We're not going to get married. We both had been turned off of marriage from everything that went on with our divorces.
Right.
The kids liked each other. We had the same house. We acted like we were married, but we're like, do we really need a ceremony? Do we got to go through all that crap again? But we ended up going ahead and doing it. But I'll save that for a different day. I'll make that part two for on Thursday. Fun. If you'll have me back.
All right, why not? Because now people have a reason to come back on Thursday. So
okay, you know. I will say this: the story of us being friends, I think, is the reason why we're so happy in our second marriages to each other, because, you know, you always kind of put up that false front when you're meeting somebody for the first time. You're putting your best foot forward. You're trying to impress. You're trying to, you know, maybe you dress a little bit better. You kind of let whatever your bad habits, you try to push those aside to try to impress that person. I was never trying to impress her. I was just me. So it was too late. I couldn't pretend to be somebody I wasn't, and she still liked me for who I was. So there's something to be said about finding your best friend first, because then you know you're always with somebody you really like.
All right, cool. That is a great story. Thank you very much, Alan. Thank you for sharing with everybody.
The whole world now
and with
knows.
Me. Well, if anyone listens to the Marriage Fit, they already heard most of that. So true. Yeah, you know. See, I do pay attention. All right. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm on 5 different social media platforms for what I do in talk radio, which is more political oriented, but I do check it. It's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Getter, and Truth Social. Just do a search for The Alan Sanders Show. You'll find me. I do tend to be on Twitter more than anything. Podcast wise, entertainment, we did a show called a podcast called The Wilder Ride for 4 seasons. That was a lot of fun. Me and my buddy Walt Murray. And as you alluded to, my wife and I do a podcast called The Marriage Fit Podcast, which is more about sharing our stories and bringing up kids and doing the things that we did as a married couple, trying to bring them up and trying to do something productive with our with our children without losing all of our hair.
Okay, makes sense. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, I'll have what she's having.
I'll definitely have what she's having.
With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you, wonderful you, had to be you.